Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Sawat in Jetta's Grove in Athempendika's park. There he addressed the monks thus, "Monks, venerable sir," they replied, "the Blessed One said this." Monks, for the most part, beings have this wish, desire, and longing. If unwished for, undesired, disagreeable things would diminish, and wished for, desired, agreeable things would increase. Yet, although beings have this wish, desire, and longing, unwished for, undesired, disagreeable things increase for them, and wished for, desired, agreeable things diminish. Now, what do you think is the reason for that? Venerable sir, our teachings are rooted in the Blessed One, guided by the Blessed One, have the Blessed One as their resort. It would be good if the Blessed One would explain the meaning of these words. Having heard it from the Blessed One, the monks will remember it. Then listen, monks, and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, venerable sir, they replied. Hear, monks, an untaught ordinary person who has no regard for noble ones and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma. Noble ones means people that have practiced the meditation and were successful. Who has no regard for true men and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma, who does not know what things should be cultivated and what things should not be cultivated. What things should be cultivated and what things should not be cultivated? Not knowing this, he cultivates that which should not be cultivated and does not cultivate things that should be cultivated. He follows things that should not be followed and does not follow things that should be followed. It is because he does this unwished for, undesired, disagreeable things increase for him, and wish for, desired, agreeable things diminish. Why is that? That is what happens to one who does not see the well-taught noble disciple, who has regard for the noble ones and is skilled and disciplined in their Dhamma, who has regard for true men, who is skilled and disciplined in their Dhamma, knows what things should be cultivated and what things should not be cultivated. He knows what things should be followed and what things should not be followed. Knowing this, he cultivates things that should be cultivated and does not cultivate things that should not be cultivated. He follows things that should be followed and does not follow things that should not be followed. It is because he does this that unwished for, undesired, disagreeable things diminish for him, and wished for, desired, agreeable things increase. Why is that? That is what happens to one who sees. There are four ways of undertaking things. What are the four? There is a way of undertaking things that is painful now and ripens in the future as pain. There is a way in with undertaking things that is pleasant now and ripens in the future as pain. There is a way of undertaking things that's painful now and ripens in the future as pleasant. There is a way of undertaking things that is pleasant now and ripens in the future as pleasant. The ignorant person. Now, monks, one who is ignorant, not knowing this way of undertaking things that is painful now and ripens in the future as pain, he does not understand as it actually is thus. This is the way of undertaking things that's painful now and ripens in the future as pain. Not knowing it, not understanding it as it actually is, the ignorant person cultivates it and does not avoid it. Because he does so, unwished for, undesired, disagreeable things increase for him, and wished for, desired, agreeable things diminish. Why is that? That is what happens to one who does not know and see. Now, monks, this does have a point to it. You'll get it in a minute. Now, monks, one who is ignorant, not knowing this way of undertaking things that is pleasant now and ripens in the future as pain, does not understand as it actually is thus. This is a way of undertaking things that is pleasant now and ripens in the future as pain. Not knowing it, not understanding it as it actually is, the ignorant one cultivates it and does not avoid it because he does so, unwished for things decrease and wished for things increase for him who wishes for these things. Why is that? That is what happens to one who does not know and see. Now, monks, one who is ignorant, not knowing this way of undertaking things that is painful now and ripens in the future as pleasure, does not understand as it actually is thus. The way of undertaking things is painful now and ripens in the future as pleasure. Not knowing it, not understanding it as it actually is, the ignorant one does not cultivate it, but avoids it. Because he does so, there we have dot, dot, dot. Things increase for him, and wish for things diminish. Unwholesome things increase for him. Why is that? That's what happens to one who does not know and see. Now, one who is ignorant, not knowing the way of undertaking things for the pleasant now, and ripens in the future as pleasure, does not understand it as it actually is thus. The way of abandoning things is pleasant now and ripens in the future as pleasure. Not knowing it, not understanding it as it actually is, the ignorant one does not cultivate it, but avoids it. Because he does so, unwished for, disagreeable things increase. And wished for, desired things diminish. That is what happens to one who does not see. A wise person. Now, monks, one who is wise, knowing this way of undertaking things that is painful now and ripens in the future as pain, understands it as it actually is. This is a way of undertaking things as painful now and ripens in the future as pain. Knowing it, understanding it as it actually is, the wise one does not cultivate it, but avoids it. Because he does so, unwished for, undesirable, disagreeable things diminish for him, and wished for, desired, agreeable things increase. That is, why is that? That is what happens to one who sees. Now, monks, one who is wise, knowing the way of undertaking things that is pleasant now and ripens in the future as pain, understands it as it actually is thus. This is a way of undertaking things, is pleasant now, and ripens in the future as pain. Knowing it, understanding it as it actually is, the wise one does not cultivate it, but avoids it because he does so. Unwished for things diminish for him, and wished for things increase. Why is that? That is what happens to one who knows and sees. Something that's pleasant now is like stealing something, and in the future you have pain. So that's what it's talking about, like that. Now, monks, one who is wise, knowing this way of undertaking things that is painful now and ripens in the future as pleasure, understands as it actually is thus. This way of taking things is painful now and ripens in the future as pleasure. Knowing it, understanding it as it actually is, the wise person does not avoid it, but cultivates it. Sitting in meditation can be sometimes painful, but you don't avoid the pain. You go through it. You use the 6 R's for that. And using the 6 R's, it starts changing things around, and then you get pleasure when you let go of your attachments and that sort of thing. But he does not avoid it, but cultivates it. Because he does so, unwished for things diminish for him, and wished for things increase. Why is that? That is what happens to one who understands and sees. Now, monks, one who is wise, knowing this way of undertaking things that is pleasant now, and ripens in the future as pleasure, understands it as it actually is thus. This way of undertaking things is pleasant now and ripens in the future as pleasure. Knowing it, understanding it as it actually is, the wise one does not avoid it but cultivates it. Because he does so, unwished for things diminish for him, and wished for things increase. Why is that? That is what happens to one who knows and sees. Knows and sees is referring to going through the experience and then seeing the advantage of letting go of old habits of doing things and developing new habits, and then the increase in happiness becomes more automatic. What, monks, is a way of undertaking things that is painful now and ripens in the future as pain? Here, monks, someone in pain and grief kills living beings, and he experiences pain and grief for having killed living beings. In pain and grief, he takes what is not given, misconducts himself in the sensual pleasure, speaks falsehood, speaks maliciously, that means dividing groups up so that they fight with each other, speaks harshly, cursing, gossips, is covetousness, has a mind of ill will, holds a wrong view, and he experiences pain and grief that have wrong view as condition, thinking it's all right to say things that aren't true, taking things that aren't given, killing things. A lot of soldiers, when they kill somebody else, it changes them a lot. And it's real hard to let go of that guilty feeling. That's what PTSD is all about. They've been made to do things that were really wrong, and they knew that they were wrong, but they did them anyway. On the dissolution of the body after death, he reappears in a state of deprivation and an unhappy destination, even in hell. That is called the way of undertaking things that is painful now and ripens in the future as pain. What, monks, is the way of undertaking things that is pleasant now and ripens in the future as pain? Here, someone is in pleasure and joy kills living beings. I think mostly of insects. And he experienced pleasure and joy that have killing of living beings as condition. In pleasure and joy, he takes what is not given. He gets excited and, oh yeah, this is just what I want. But the guilty feeling comes back up. He holds wrong views and he experiences pleasure and joy that have wrong views as condition. On the dissolution of the body after death, he reappears in a state of deprivation, in an unhappy destination, even in hell. This is called the way of undertaking things that is pleasant now and ripens in the future as pain. When monks, or what, monks, is a way of undertaking things that is painful now and ripens in the future as pleasure? Here, monks, someone in pain and grief abstains from killing living beings, and he experiences pain and grief that have abstention from killing living beings as condition. In pain and grief, abstaining from taking what is not given. This would be an interesting sutta for Doug Croft to read. From misconduct in sensual pleasures, from speaking falsehood, from speaking maliciously, from speaking harshly, from gossiping, he is not covetous. He does not have a mind of ill will. He holds a right view, and he experiences pain and grief that have right view as condition. On the dissolution of the body after death, he reappears in a happy destination, even in a heavenly world. This is called the way of undertaking things that is painful now and ripens in the future as pleasure. So, even though you're suffering, you and this is directly about killing living beings. You're suffering because you see their suffering. That doesn't mean euthanasia is the way to get them to overcome their suffering. What happens is, whether they like to believe it or not, the people that kill another living being purposefully, they feel guilty after that. They try to justify it and say, well, they were going to die anyway, and I took them out of their misery. I don't go along with taking animals to a vet and having a vet put them to sleep. Put them to sleep is not a good term. It's killing them. And every living being wants to live as long as they possibly can, even when they're in pain. They don't want to die. So what you can do is be with them as much as you possibly can. When they're getting close to death, they take comfort in the fact that you're there with them, because you've always been there with them. And they know that they trust that your pain of seeing them go is not going to cause you a lot of pain. You can still miss the animals after they die, yes, of course. But you don't have that guilty feeling of doing that. One of the problems that I've had with Christians for a long time is that they think it's okay to kill living beings. And they justify, well, they were in pain. He had a broken back. And the vet couldn't do anything because it was going to cost $5,000 to try to fix it, and it might not get fixed. So we'll just put them to sleep instead. But you feel guilty when you do that, even though they're there and they're in pain. You don't have to feel helpless. What you do is you start radiating loving kindness to them and to yourself. So that way you don't feel like you're doing nothing, because you are helping them. You're helping them so that they will have a peaceful death. I spent about a year in a nursing home, and my mother ran the nursing home. And the reason that I was there was because I wanted to be with people as they died, so they could have an uplifted mind. This one lady in particular, she had cancer in the brain, and there was a lot of pain. But as she got closer and closer to death, I would spend all my time with them, reminding them of things that they did in the past that was really nice, that they really liked that, and they helping other people, and remembering times when you laughed with your friends and things like that. So I would remind them of that, and the times that they were generous and helped other people. And because most of them were Christian, I wasn't trying to force the Buddhism on them. I would just get them to remember these kind of things. And their pain, actually, when they got closer and closer to death, became less. And you could see it on their faces. You could see them starting to let go of the tensions and over concerns and dislike of the idea of dying and that sort of thing. So when they died, quite often they would have a smile on their lips as they were dying, because they were in a memory of wholesomeness, of helping and doing other things for people, and they weren't over concerned. I had an uncle that died, and he had a bad heart for a lot of years, and he started smiling right before he died. And my aunt said, "What? Why are you smiling?" And he said, "I'm going home." So, there can be times when it is painful now, but they can be reborn in a more pleasurable place than now. They can be reborn as a human being, or in the Devaloka, or if you've done meditation, you probably will get in a Brahmaloka somewhere, or a Devaloka means a regular heavenly realm. It's the heavenly realms where people that don't know about mental development and getting deep into your meditation, but they live good lives. They've spent their life helping other people. And my mother, when she died, she was one of the most compassionate people I'd ever known. And her face was just radiant as she was dying. It's pretty amazing. So if you're with somebody that's dying, you radiate loving kindness to them, or you radiate equanimity. In other words, having a balanced feeling in your mind so that they can accept what's happening without resisting it. Now, she didn't know anything about meditation. I never tried to tell her about meditation, even though I've been doing it since the 70s. I told her I was meditating. She never asked what I was doing, how to do it, or any of that. I didn't push it, because she had her own way, and she did have, she spent quite a bit of time praying, 5-10 minutes, that sort of. Huh? Well, she would never have done that, but because she saw the changes that I was going through, and she agreed with them. So, yeah. So they're not going to be born in a Brahmaloka, which lasts for really, really, really long periods of time. But there's a chart in the dining hall that it has 6 different levels of Devaloka, depending on where. I don't know if you've seen it, but the earthbound spirits, they stay around the earth, and they one day. In the Devaloka, the earthbound spirits, is equivalent to 50 years here. And they live to be about 100 years. So they live for a long time in a happy realm. The next one is called the Tavsatimsa heaven. And this is where, I don't know if you've run across any literature about Sakka. He's the king of the 33. But it's you. One day there is equivalent to 100 years here. So as you go up, it gets to be longer and longer. The next Buddha, the Bodhisattva, he's in the fourth level. It's called the Tusita realm. And one day there is equivalent to 400 years here. Now, all of these Devalokas, they have to eat or else they will die. And what they eat is grapes just kind of magically appear. So they're munching on grapes all the time. And when you learn to do the meditation and you go deep and you get into the first jhana or second jhana or third jhana, then it starts lasting for long periods of time. And let's say you get to the third jhana and you never went any higher. It's such a pleasure, it's a very pleasurable realm, and it lasts for 16 mahakalpas. That's how long you'll be in that realm. And the food that they need is joy. So they have joy all the time, and that keeps their body, it's a more subtle body than the heavenly realms. And it goes up so that it's really, really long periods of time. There's four parts to an expansion and contraction of the universe. Now, this goes way beyond the scientific thinking of it right now. But there's four what they call asankhyas. You can believe this or not, doesn't matter. That an asankhya is when the universe is expanding. And it keeps going out and going out and going out. Eventually it stops for an asankhya. Long period of time. And then it starts coming back in until it gets to really, really small. And then it stops for another asankhya. Now, according to Buddhist numbers, which quite often are not very accurate, but it gives you an idea of how long a period of time it is, one asankhya is equivalent to 10 to the 160th power. So there's a really long time going out. Now, four of those make up one mahakalpa. A mahakalpa is, 540, with 540 zeros behind it. So that's the expansion and contractions of the universe 16 times before you would, your merit would be exhausted, and then you're reborn in another realm, whether it would be human being or animal or whatever. So these are huge long distances and long periods of time that you would be in a pleasurable realm. And this is, it's when you do the meditation and you start letting go of the hindrances and that sort of thing that come up, then it gets to be really, really pleasurable. And that's what Jeanette was experiencing quite a bit. So she was really happy now And she is going to be very happy in the future for a long period of time. So, that gives you a little bit of an idea of, the thing with Christians that I've always objected to is you die, you go to heaven, or you go to hell. That's it. And the universe isn't like that. And karma doesn't work like that. You can be in a very pleasurable realm for a period of time until the good karma that you made from helping other people and doing kind things for people and making people happy, eventually the good karma will just become exhausted. And then other karma will come in, and that shows you where you're going to be reborn in another. But the idea of everything forever and ever, it just, that's not the way the universe works. So I kind of object to that kind of thinking. So, and that's me. You can have that belief or not. It's up to you. It doesn't really matter. It just doesn't make sense to my mind. What, monks, is the way of undertaking things that's pleasant now and ripens in the future as pleasure? Here, monks, someone in pleasure and joy abstains from killing living beings, and he experiences pleasure and joy that have abstention from killing living beings as condition. In pleasure and joy, he abstains from taking what is not given. He holds to right views. He keeps his... He does not break the precept of wrong sexual activity. Wrong sexual activity is not having sexual activity with another person's mate. Not having sexual activity with someone that's under the care of their parents that are too young. Or having sexual activity that causes pain to arise in anyone else. But outside of that, it's up to you whether you want to have sexual activity or not. You're not breaking, you're not sinning if you have sexual activity and it's consensual and nobody else is going to object to that. So it's kind of goes along with the laws of the land. Now, I was in Malaysia, and the Malaysians, they can have four wives. Men can have four wives. And that's not against the law. So that's okay for them to do that. I don't know why anybody would want to. But because they have to be pretty wealthy, they have to give the house to each wife. They can't have them in under the same roof because that just doesn't work very well. But the laws of the land here are that you have one. Okay, so we have to follow that, and it's not breaking the precept. So not having sexual activity with somebody else's mate and not causing anybody else pain, then that is called right sexual activity. So that we're not quite as prudish as some of the Christian ideas. It's a little bit more open than that. And actually, getting married in other countries is quite a bit different than it is here. Quite often, it's just the couple agreeing that they're going to be husband and wife, then they are husband and wife. They don't have to have a license and all of this kind of stuff. So, on the dissolution of the body after death, he reappears in a happy destination, even in a heavenly world. This is called the way of undertaking things that is pleasant now and ripens in the future as pleasure. I wanted to tell you about some of my students in Indonesia. There's an American man that got married to an Indonesian woman. And right before they got married, the American man's father took him aside and he said, "Do you want to have a successful marriage?" And of course he did. And he said, "The way you have a successful marriage is by allowing your wife to always be right." So when you're always, the woman is always right, then there's not going to be any fighting about things. And what happens, they've been married 8 years now, and they haven't had an argument in 8 years. They don't get snippy with each other. They don't disagree and yell at each other and have all of these kind of problems. So what happens is, she says, "Let's do this." He doesn't really want to do it, but he agrees with her. And then they discuss it. Not necessarily right then, but they'll discuss what they're going to be doing. And they wind up agreeing on, this is a good thing, so we'll do it, or not. So that's a way of softening the marriage. And they giggle and laugh all the time with each other. And sometimes she'll pipe up and say, "You know I'm right." So there's no argument. You know I'm right. But it really does work. So okay, we have some similes here. Monks, suppose there were a bitter gourd mixed with poison, and a man who wanted to live, not to die, who wanted pleasure and recoiled from pain. Do you know what bitter gourd is? Yeah, it's kind of squash, and it's bitter. There's not many ways that you can fix it that it's not bitter. That I know of, anyway. I was staying at a monastery. Sri Lankans love this stuff. And I was staying at a monastery that was Sri Lankan. And there was an American cook, but the head monk wanted bitter gourd every day. 90 different recipes to make the bitter gourd taste better didn't help. 3 months there was bitter gourd on the... Okay. And someone told him, "Good man, this bitter gourd is mixed with poison. Drink from it if you want. As you drink from it, its color, smell, and taste would not agree with you. And after drinking it, you will come to death or deadly suffering." That makes sense if somebody's putting poison in your medicine. Then he drank from it without reflecting and did not relinquish it. As he drank from it, the color, smell, and taste did not agree with him. And after drinking it, he came to death or deadly suffering. Similar to that, I say, is the way of undertaking things that is painful now and ripens in the future as pain. Suppose there were a bronze cup of beverage possessing good color, good smell, and taste, but it was mixed with poison, and a man came who wanted to live, not die. He wanted pleasure and recoiled from pain, and they told him, good man, this bronze cup of beverage possesses good color, good smell, and good taste, but it's mixed with poison. Drink it if you want. As you drink from it, its color, smell, and taste will agree with you, but after drinking from it, you will come to death or deadly suffering. Then he drank from it without reflecting and did not relinquish it. As he drank from it, its color, smell, and taste agreed with him, but after drinking it, he came to death or deadly suffering. Similar to that, I say, is a way of undertaking things that's pleasant now and ripens in the future as pain. Suppose there were fermented urine mixed with various medicines. Monks have medicinal requisites, and one of the things that is allowable for monks is cow urine. It's not as bad as you think it is. It's the worst part about cow urine. You have to put it out in the sun for a few days. And the worst part about it is the smell. And it gets into your skin, and you start smelling like it after a few days, so you're not real popular during those times. But it does overcome a lot of illnesses. Of course, during the time of the Buddha, they didn't have antibiotics and such. They had to use the herbs. A lot of the herbs, I had 12 years of herbs given to me, and I haven't found too many of them that are agreeable and likable. They're hard to drink. Okay, suppose there were fermented urine mixed with various medicines. And a man came sick with jaundice, and they told him, good man, this fermented urine is mixed with various medicines. Drink it if you want. As you drink it, its color, smell, and taste will not agree with you. That's the Asian medicines. But after drinking it, you will be well. An interesting thing happened, and it seems to happen fairly often in Asia, is a child that's just born will get jaundice. And a family came to me, and the baby was 2 days old, and they had jaundice, and they said, can you help in any way? So I said, okay. So I started radiating loving kindness to that baby, and the jaundice went away. So I did that for 3 or 4 days, and I asked the family how the baby was. Oh, the jaundice is gone. When I stopped, it came back. Yeah. So I had to do it for about a week. No, the baby was in the hospital, and I didn't go visit the baby. They just gave me the name of the baby. That was enough. So then he drank from it after reflecting and did not relinquish it. As he drank from it, its color, taste, and smell did not agree with him, but after drinking it, he became well. Similar to that, I say, is the way of undertaking things that's painful now and ripens in the future as pleasure. Suppose there were a curd, honey, ghee, molasses mixed together. The curd is kind of like cottage cheese. And with the honey and ghee is clarified butter and molasses. It's not a bad tasting concoction. A man with dysentery came. They told him, good man, this curd, honey, ghee, and molasses mixed together, drink it if you want. As you drink from it, the color, smell, and taste will agree with you. And after drinking from it, you will be well. Then he drank from it after reflecting and did not relinquish it. As he drank from it, its color, smell, and taste agreed with him. After drinking from it, he became well. Similar to that, I say, is the way of undertaking things that's pleasant now and ripens in the future as pleasure. Just as in the autumn, in the last month of the rainy season, when the sky is clear and cloudy, cloudless, the sun rises above the earth, dispelling all darkness from space with its shining, beaming, and radiance. So too, the way of undertaking things that's pleasant now and ripens in the future is pleasant, dispels with its shining and beaming and radiance any other doctrines, whatever, whatsoever, of ordinary recluses and Brahmins. That's what the Blessed One said. The monks were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. One of the things that you'll start to notice as you start to have more and more wholesome, uplifting thoughts is you'll get a thought of, gee, I wish I had this or that. And it comes. It just kind of magically appears. I went to Australia. You've heard this so many times. And it was the coldest... but it was the coldest day of the year when I arrived there. And I came from Malaysia, where it was between 85 and 90 all the time, and I'm coming in. And it was cold. There wasn't frost on the ground, but it was cold. And I was completely unprepared for it. I had no idea what I was thinking of. So I'm walking around in Sydney, and my feet got very cold because all I had was a pair of sandals. So I started thinking about how nice it would be to have a pair of socks. And I went to a monastery. The first thing they did was they gave me a pair of socks. Within a week, I had a dozen pair of socks. And to this day, I can't turn the socks off. They keep coming. There's one time I went to California. Somebody gave me 24 pair of socks. What am I going to do with 24 pair of socks? So I give them away. But one of the things is, what you give, that you get back. So I give all these socks away and I still have socks coming at me. So, and this is the kind of thing that can happen for you. So it's interesting because the more wholesome you become, more magical life becomes. And just a brief little wish that you don't really focus on much, all of a sudden, there it is. I don't have a pen. There's a pen that appears. Not kinda. Well, it depends on conditions all the way. But it gets to be kind of fun. I visualized this all exactly like you see it right now. And I just sat back and waited for it to happen. And it did. So it works with big things as well as small things. But again, it's when you take care of Dhamma, Dhamma takes care of you. And this is really true. I spend my time taking care of Dhamma. I don't have any money to speak of. But this whole place, it's happening. Because I take care of Dhamma. So it's... You don't always get what you want, but you always get what you need. And that's really true. You know, it would be nice to wish for... Well, I wish I had $2 million. Well, I can hold my breath on that. But we needed another cabin down below. Somebody donated the cabin. Great stuff. Really good. Anyway, why don't we share some merit? May suffering ones be suffering free, and the fear-struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief, and may all beings find relief. May all beings share this merit that we thus acquired for the acquisition of all kinds of happiness. May beings inhabiting space and earth, devas and nagas of mighty power, share this merit of ours. May they all protect the Buddha's dispensation. Sadhu.